So yesterday, where we left off, I feel like on retrospect, or in retrospect, the last 10 minutes I may have been rushing a little bit. So I'd like to, so I don't think I did a very good job in the last 10 minutes of the talk yesterday, where we were discussing the hierarchy problem. So I'd like to quickly go over and recap that stuff. Also, I decided to change to alter the content a little bit. So in these talks, I've decided not to cover supersymmetry. So the online notes have a lot of information on supersymmetry, and there's many, many textbooks on supersymmetry. And also, nothing really has changed much apart in the last, decade or so, apart from the LHC constraints on supersymmetry getting stronger. So I feel like it would be better if I focus on the up-to-date stuff that people are really thinking about and working on nowadays, where new ideas are coming out. So that will probably be a lot more interesting to you guys. Another thing I should mention is that there are some sample homework problems at the end of the lecture notes online. They're not compulsory. However, if you want to take a look at them, this evening, take a look at some of them, then tomorrow I'd be very happy to discuss them if anyone has any questions about them. Or even after I finish the lectures, if you have any questions, just email me. My email address, you'll be able to find it online. And I'd be happy to discuss, and I have example solutions. So if anyone's interested in those problems and wants to take a stab at them, then please do. Okay, so back to pions one more time. So treating the if we only had an experiment working below the QCD scale, which was the case for a long time, we could produce pions in the lab and measure their masses and measure their interactions. And we'd see that at lowest order, the effective action for the pions would look something like this. It'd be a neutral pion and a charged pion. They have masses. And we would also see, actually, let me rewrite this bit. We would also see that the charged pion has charge, so it interacts with the photon. Okay, so we have our experiment working below the GeV scale, and we've measured these particles, and we see that they exist, but we haven't managed to get to the GeV scale yet. And by staring at this action, we know that we're working with an effective theory, so there will be lots of other terms. Let's call it dot, dot, dot. There will be lots of other terms in the effective action that are higher dimension operators, like we discussed yesterday. But already we can see that this theory has no special symmetries that could keep the charged pion light. One of the main symmetries you could use to keep a scalar field light is a shift symmetry, as we discussed yesterday. But we see that there's actually no shift symmetry here whatsoever. So we're obliged, we're doing effective field theory. We don't know what is happening in the UV. We don't know what happens at the GeV scale. So we're obliged to write down every term we're allowed. And where we need a dimensionful parameter, we put in the cutoff of the theory. So in this mass term, there's nothing stopping us from having corrections to the mass that go something like E squared, because we know that, as far as we're aware, that might be the only parameter that breaks the shift symmetry of the pion, apart from just its bare mass. And then we have the cutoff squared, because we're obliged to absorb all dimensionful parameters that we need with the cutoff. And then pi plus squared. So this is a mass term. So we've constructed our effective field theory, and there will, of course, be all the other terms as well. We've constructed our effective field theory, and we know that there should be terms like this, and we have quadratic sensitivity to the cutoff. And the reason we know it is that we have terms that clearly violate the shift symmetry of the pion. If E was zero, if the pion, charged pion wasn't charged, then we could say, well, maybe there's, to a good approximation, apart from this term, there's a shift symmetry. So we don't have quadratic sensitivity to the cutoff. Sadly, that's not the case. So staring at this term, we could say, well, there are many things that we can learn from this, that we can also measure the pion mass, and it's not too big, it's 140 MeV. So we can plug that into here and see where the cutoff must be, and the cutoff of this interaction must be something like 600 or 700 MeV. In order for the mass correction to not be so large as to start to pull the pion mass up. So we know that the cutoff should be around there, or it could be that the true cutoff of the theory is very high, and there's some other magic going on that suppresses these terms, but we don't know what it is. But at this level, we can't see what that magic could be because we've exhausted all of the possible symmetries we could have used. Or we could say, well, maybe there's maybe this term is really big. Say maybe the cutoff is 100 GeV, this term is massive, and nature has decided to fine-tune this term against this term to just precisely cancel it such you get something small left over. It turns out that what nature did is exactly what you would expect from the EFT if you measure the charged pion mass and more importantly the mass difference between the neutral pion and the charged pion. You see that there is actually new physics that kicks in. There is a cutoff around 700 MeV, and this is all of the resonances of QCD, and the true cutoff is you know around a GeV or something like that. So here, by applying just really basic effective field theory arguments, you can guess where the cutoff of the theory will be by assuming that no parameters have been especially finely tuned or there aren't some magical things happening in the UV. And you get exactly the right answer. Treating the standard model as an effective field theory, which we're sort of obliged to do because we don't know what happens in the UV. Yep.
Oh, sorry, in that equation, are you taking the mass of the charge pions and the mass of the pi zero to be the same?
It doesn't matter. So they are, we measure them to be, so we can, but that's not, doesn't affect whether or not this guy's here.
No, sure, but if you're going to make fine-tuning arguments, then that's going to affect the mass of the pi zero as well, right? If you say that they're approximately the same.
And then so that's a good point. But yeah, so you can see that the pi zero doesn't play a role in this argument. So if there was a symmetry that linked these two guys, then you're absolutely right. If I pulled this up to try and fine tune it against this sort of correction, I would have also pulled that up as well. So yeah, so there would be a double mystery. However, it could have been that maybe nature not only fine-tuned this guy against this guy, but fine-tuned that combination against this combination to make them look like to make them have masses that are approximately similar. But yes, the approximate symmetry that keeps them similar in mass plays a part in the whole story. But at first glance, you could ignore these parts if you wanted and just compare these two. Yep.
Where did the 700 MeV come from?
So you put in e squared, this probably the full thing has a loop factor, so this is really like alpha squared, or alpha, sorry. And you want the correction to not be larger than, say, 100, well, you want the correction actually not to be too much larger than the mass splitting here, because precisely this point, not larger than, say, 5 MeV to the mass. So that implies a correction to the mass squared, and you just can rearrange this, and that's the number you get out. Okay, so what's going on in the standard model? So we don't know what is in the UV for the standard model. We will never know for sure until we go there with an experiment and check it. So the same rules of the game apply. You treat the standard model like an effective field theory. There must be some cutoff where some new physics comes in. I don't know what the cutoff is. Nobody does. There's probably at least one associated with physics at the Planck scale, but there could be other things. Where right-handed neutrino masses come in, all sorts of things. So we play exactly the same game, and we have in the standard model all of the normal terms, but then we see already in the standard model we have terms like this for the Higgs boson. And we have terms that involve a quartic interaction. And we have Yukawa couplings. I'll just consider the top for now, but we have all of the Yukawa couplings. So we have all of these terms, and you see that there's no, and we have a bare mass term. You see that there's no symmetry, there's no shift symmetry that is respected by this action. This coupling breaks the shift symmetry, as does this one, as does this one. So playing by the same rules of the game, then we should expect that there are corrections to the mass that are going something like lambda squared, and then things like g squared, you know, plus 3 lambda top squared, plus maybe even the quartic as well, not squared, multiplying the Higgs mass. But we've measured what this term, what the total Higgs mass is. We measured it. We've now measured the VeV and we've measured the Higgs mass. So we know exactly what the total m squared term is here, and it's not enormous. So we apply exactly the same logic, and we see that the cutoff shouldn't, if we plug in the numbers just like we did for the pions, shouldn't be more than say 500 or 600 GeV at most. Otherwise, we would have to fine-tune some bare mass parameter against these corrections, or something else special would have to be going on. But now with the LHC, we've measured all of the standard model particles, and we've searched for more particles, and nothing has shown up. We've got to 500 or 600 GeV, and nothing has shown up. And this is essentially the hierarchy problem. If the standard model is UV completed by some new physics at the cutoff lambda, then this cutoff lambda would have to be less than 500 or 600 GeV in order to not require some sort of fine-tuning to be going on. So are there any questions about that? Because that's what I said, explained very badly yesterday. Nope. Okay, excellent.
So what do I need to write down the E squared and lambda squared term? So was it that you saw that there was an
undercoupling
to E between E and pi plus?
Okay. So there's no, so E is a parameter, is at least one parameter we know of that breaks the shift symmetry. So there's nothing that can forbid in the effective field theory corrections like this. One way you could see it, another way you could see it is to write down diagrams involving, for example, a loop of photons. So this would be pi plus, and this integral here will go something like, yeah, pretty much, it'll go something like this, d1 over d4q, and you have a q squared for the propagator. So you see that you have quadratic sensitivity to the cutoff. I'm not, this is a very quick way of seeing that you will generate these terms, but it also, you don't need to draw loop diagrams to really see that. You can just see it purely based on symmetry arguments. But you can also see it by looking at loop diagrams. But there could be, for example, non-perturbative physics that we can't really write as a loop diagram that will also generate these things. But we can believe that it should be proportional to E squared, because if I take E to zero, then apart from these terms, which aren't interactions, if I set E to zero, then I have a shift symmetry. So I can believe that there's a symmetry respected by the physics in the UV that wouldn't generate these guys.
This is just that Fourier story that you say.
Precisely. Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Is it possible that you could have a non-order one parameter in front of your EFT expansion, and therefore that's what's causing the scale to be pushed?
Right, exactly. So could there be some magic that makes this some Wilson coefficient in here that's very, very small? Usually, no. As I said yesterday, when Wilson coefficients are very small, it usually is telling you that there's some sort of symmetry, and we will discuss those sorts of symmetries later. But yes, but maybe in the UV there are lots of different contributions that come together and cancel off each other and leave you with a small Wilson coefficient. But that would really be a fine-tuning again. Yep.
Why did you have to write E squared and not E or E cubed or something?
Ah, yes, good. Good question. So do you remember yesterday when I was saying the difference between couplings and scales? So lambda itself was actually a scale, not a mass. So I know that there's going to be some coupling here. If I had written this as an actual term that contains a mass, then I wouldn't necessarily have to have the E squared, but still I know it must vanish as E squared, can plausibly vanish as E goes to zero. Yep.
How do you determine the sign of that term?
Oh, you've no idea. It's some unknown number.
You said the argument for E squared, but how do you know it's lambda squared? Can you have lambda or lambda cubed?
Because that's the dimension of mass squared. Okay, so let's now go on to discuss some possible approaches to the hierarchy problem. So I want to do briefly some things that don't really work or maybe don't work, but we don't know how they work yet, before I go on to then sort of discuss more concrete examples where we can calculate things. So some approaches that you might discuss or see discussed are scale invariants, or one of them is scale invariants. And the basic argument, so there are two arguments, one I don't agree with and one I agree with. One argument is that these interactions here, for example, all of these, respect that scale symmetry that I talked about earlier, where if you rescale the coordinates and rescale the fields in the same way, you've respected a scale symmetry. So if your theory has a scale symmetry, how could it possibly generate dimensionful terms for you? And that is absolutely correct. If you have a theory that respects this scale symmetry, even at the quantum level, then there will be no dimensionful terms generated ever. In the standard model, there's one caveat that doesn't really worry me so much, which is that the standard model, the scale invariance is not respected at the quantum level. We already know this, for example, for QCD. QCD interactions respect a classical scale symmetry, but quantum effects mean that the QCD strong coupling actually changes as you run down in energy scale, and eventually the strong coupling becomes large. There's non-perturbative effects that become very large, and a whole bunch of resonances appear at the GEV scale. We call that dimensional transmutation. You generate a scale from a theory that doesn't have any scale. So those are two problems. But the biggest problem is, I don't think they're too bad, but the biggest problem is that this doesn't work, right? We know already that you could have made exactly the same argument for the pion. You could have said, well, this interaction here respects the scale symmetry, so how could it generate a dimensionful term? The reason it doesn't work is because there is another scale in the theory. There's a UV scale where there's new states. In this case, it was the rho meson and so on. If your entire action were just this, without the UV states at high energies, and it were just, you know, massive pions, then you can buy that argument that you will never generate a large mass correction, because if the entire theory is just this, then it's not there. But the problem is there is a cutoff. And when there is a cutoff, then you can't forbid these sorts of terms. So, and the cutoff explicitly breaks scale symmetry. So there is a new physics scale above the pion mass, and that new physics scale breaks the scale symmetry itself. It exists, so it doesn't work. So if the standard model was, if all you had was the standard model, the renormalizable standard model, then, and if that was all of nature, then I think it's a very plausible argument that that you have no large corrections to the Higgs mass from the cutoff, because that is the whole theory. You can redefine everything into counter terms and you're good. The problem is that we know that the standard model is not the whole story. We know there's a cutoff and there's new physics at some higher energy scale, so it doesn't work. But nonetheless, some brave souls are still studying models where you could try and use this idea and embed the standard model into, for example, a framework that involves quantum gravity, where you don't generate any new scales, where there really is no cutoff, and then it could potentially work. So I think it's a promising research direction, but it has problems. They may or may not be insurmountable. Yep.
I mean, there's a new scale in the theory, but none of the operators in the Lagrangian explicitly have that in. So why does that then come in when you...
With the pion?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're saying... So what this is telling us is, you know, the pion has interactions with other new heavy states. So if it didn't have interactions, if there was a new scale in the theory and the pion didn't know about it, didn't interact with any of that physics, then there'd be no problem. But if there's a new scale where the pion has interactions, there's no symmetry that can forbid these sorts of terms from being generated.
So is the idea, the people, the brave souls, is the idea that they're saying that whatever the massive states, whatever the sector is that's massive that's giving you those contributions, they're extending the scale invariance to that sector as well?
Exactly, okay. Exactly. So this is like Strumius stuff. Uh-huh. You know, they're trying to make, to UV complete GR in such a way, you know, they have some higher derivative actions, so they have ghosts and things like this, but they're trying to make it scale invariant the whole way up, so there really is no cutoff ever, and then these sorts of things don't come up. Yep.
You mean no cutoff ever, or
yep.
Planck scale?
No, so you go the whole way through the Planck scale, and there's no cutoff ever. So the Planck scale comes from dimension in their setup, dimensional transmutation, like the QCD scale. There's some physics where it there's a UV completion of gravity of GR, which is some higher derivative thing. So there are new states that show up but don't give you these, they maintain the sort of scale invariance. Yeah.
Would that mean that whatever your dark matter is, it can't couple to the Higgs at all? Because that's a higher...
Right, great. No, it's a great question. So, yeah, if the dark matter is super duper heavy, then you have a problem because that mass scale would be very, very big. But imagine the dark matter couples, like the model we wrote down yesterday, you know, with just some quartic term. I'll call it kappa because I'm using lambda everywhere. This is the dark matter particle, chi. And then this is the Higgs. If the mass of chi is, you know, say a TeV or something, then the corrections, you will get corrections from similar sorts of diagrams, but they will be to the Higgs mass, but they will be of order, you know, a loop factor times a TeV, so they're not too bad. They're not a problem. But if the Higgs was, if dark matter is super duper heavy, there are problems with that. But if it was super duper heavy and the Higgs interacted with it, then that would introduce a naturalness problem. Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
If you do dimension, if you do a cutoff or some kind of dimensional regularization in a scale invariant way, is that still
right? Yeah, this is not a question of regulators. This is so like I said, if you just had the standard model, the renormalizable standard model, and absolutely nothing else, then there are quadratic divergences, but you can absorb them into the counter terms, and you're in no problem. This is only, so it's not a question of how you regularize your theory. It is a question of, for example, one way of thinking about it is if the Higgs interacts with a new heavy particle, say you measure the Higgs mass at very high energy scales, it will have picked up loop corrections to its mass of order that new heavy particle, say above the mass of that particle. And you run down, and then to get a small Higgs mass at low energies, you'd have to essentially, at the threshold of that particle, have to have cancellations between terms that are not involving your regulator. So yes, it's not a question, which is why I don't like drawing these diagrams. It's not really a question of how you regularize the theory. It's just if the Higgs is interacting with other heavy states, you can calculate the corrections. Yep.
So Strumi and company, they go gravitational on us, but does anyone ask a more limited question that is, say there was a whole bunch of massive states at 10 to the 10 GeV or something way below the Planck scale that were scale invariant? Has anyone seen if you can make a model that build scale invariance and at that scale and those masses drop out? Where you don't have to deal with gravity?
Yeah, I think people have, but I don't know. I don't have, I mean, yeah, I think if you're weakly coupled to some CFT, people have definitely studied this. If you weakly couple the standard model to some CFT, what happens? You know, like it's sort of unparticle-ish. But I don't know the answer. Okay, so scale invariance, it's an interesting and promising, but it has some issues. Another possibility is breaking QFT. Now this is gonna sound really crazy, but I actually think this is, who knows what will happen, but I think this is probably one of the most interesting places to look. So all of these arguments boil down to what we call this Wilsonian picture of effective field theories. And the Wilsonian picture is on a very concrete footing, but it's inherently quantum field theory-ish. So imagine just above the electroweak scale, everything goes to hell. You violate some fundamental principle of quantum field theory in some way, maybe Lorentz invariance, causality, unitarity, or something like this. Then our entire intuition about what happens in quantum field theories goes out the window. So perhaps there's some way that you could have violation of some core principle where you don't get a problem. And in fact, there's one example. It's not pretty, but it exists, which is the Lee-Wick standard model, where you essentially introduce states just above the weak scale that have negative norms. So you take the dot product of, you know, if you take the dot product of two of your Bra and your Ket in quantum mechanics, you'll get a negative number for these states. And indeed, what these states do is they exactly cancel all of the quadratic divergences. So this is a sort of a crazy sounding thing, but people have explored it a little bit. Maybe it will get explored a lot more. I don't know. Another thing you could do is break calculability.
So the weak thing you say, so you can violate causality?
Yes. Yeah, microcausality. So these states are at a TEV.
Right.
So at macroscopic distances, you just see causality as normal. But if you were to go to very small distances, you would see violations of causality in this model. So there are many reasons that this could make you vomit, but it exists. It exists, right?
How do I probe it?
Right. So you wouldn't actually. We're not very good at extracting causality from LHC results, but we can look for resonances. And this theory, just like pretty much every theory that attempts to address the hierarchy problem, has new resonances, which are these negative norm states at a TEV or something like this.
But is there a way to distinguish this from the more traditional Susie Partner or other?
At a first glance, so you would distinguish them because they look exactly like standard model particles in this model, but with negative norm. But you wouldn't, you would see them as a resonance first, and then you would learn something crazy is going on later. You would not, I don't think that you would know that something absurd is happening until you studied it a bit further. One thing is that you could say, I don't care. You could say the Higgs mass is not a prediction, can in no way be predicted by the fundamental theory. So you see, with the pions, we know what the UV completion is, it's QCD. And you can actually calculate the pion masses pretty much. You can take QCD and you can put it on the lattice and calculate what the pion mass is. You could say, my UV completion, whatever it is, has a bunch of input parameters and the Higgs mass is one of them. And I can never, from my UV completion, I can never predict what the Higgs mass is. So I just absorb all of this muck into the counter term for the Higgs mass, which I can't calculate anyway. It's just an input parameter. And I put it in there. And what's the problem? The problem there is that you're essentially giving up on reductionism, right? You're saying, my job as a particle physicist to understand nature does not apply to the Higgs. I don't want to understand it. I just want to argue away any possibility of ever having a theory that tells us why the weak scale is where it is. I'm being flippant, but maybe something like this is happening. I don't know. The last thing that I won't discuss, but I also think it's very interesting, is anthropics. So what if there's if the vacuum of the full of the UV completion, not the standard model, but if the vacuum of the full UV completion has lots of minima and maxima all over the place, and if you're living in different parts of this of the vacuum, the parameters of the standard model have different values, then imagine there's something like 10 to the, 32 of these different vacua. And in each one of these different vacua, the Higgs mass is a different value. So it can take all sorts of different values between minus the cutoff and plus the cutoff, minus the cutoff squared and plus the cutoff squared. So there's distributions everywhere. And then perhaps the vacua where the Higgs mass is really big just happened to never create life. Life is impossible in those vacua. Then you would have an understanding about why the Higgs mass is small, not because you're predicting it to be small, but you would never live in a universe where you could measure it to be anything other than small. I find the logic of anthropics, the basic logic of anthropics to be very sound. There is a question, though, about whether or not you could have, life that could measure the Higgs boson mass. In other universes with larger weak scales, it looks like you could or you couldn't, depending on what parameters you allow to vary. Yep.
So when I've previously heard explanations of anthropic principles, it's generally we happen to live in the universe with this one, like luck of the draw. That's just what happened. Why is there any restriction? Why would, if you have to pick one out of the many, why would saying and those can't support life change the fact that you have to pick one of the many?
Well, it does. I mean, it means you're only ever in. So,
yeah.
So the anthropics is very, very predictive.
Mm-hmm.
Anthropics says there are many, many vacua
mm-hmm.
with different Higgs masses. Anthropics says something like there's not just, the standard model
mm-hmm.
and then one or two more particles. It says that there has to be an extraordinarily rich vacuum structure of whatever the UV completion is. But then if only the ones with the small Higgs mass are habitable, then you have an explanation. But the model is the very rich vacuum of the theory. So it is actually very predictive. The problem is you can't sadly go to the other universes and test if they exist. Yep.
Is that just a nonsense, or is there a reason why life could not develop?
Right. So for example, good question. So for anthropics, for the cosmological constant problem, There's a very clear reason. If the cosmological constant were much bigger, the universe would have exploded and we never would have had any structure formation. With the weak scale, it's much more subtle. If you were to take the standard model and keep all of the parameters like the Yukawa couplings and everything fixed, then there, you can make an argument that if you vary the weak scale too much, you can do things like spoil the neutron-proton mass difference, and then you muck around with nuclear physics, and you wouldn't create heavy elements, and you wouldn't have life and things like this. The problem is that I don't know of any study that's been done that allows all of these parameters to vary altogether, which they should. There's no reason that it's just the Higgs mass. I don't know of any study that lets them all vary altogether and finds a place where, you know, a weak scale of 10 TeV is completely uninhabitable for any other values of the parameters. So, it's on very strong footing, I think, for the cosmological constant. For the weak scale, I'm not so convinced, but I'm not unconvinced either. I don't fully know the answer.
Don't you implicitly assume that, you know, so you didn't create heavy elements, so you don't create life. That implicitly assumes life like us. Do we have any reason for believing that, you know, you couldn't get life in some very radically different form that we have difficulty imagining without heavy elements?
Yeah, I don't know. After all, have anyone watched the latest season of Star Trek? You know, you could have these, fungus things that are, you know, very different. I don't know. Yeah, it's a very good question.
There's a sense in which it's predictive, like you said, but there's a sense in which it's only postdictive, in the sense that, in practice, the way we use it is we say, we're not going to talk about these parameters anymore, and then we don't never know in advance which ones we're not going to talk about.
Yeah. It's predictive that in the UV there has to be some complex vacuum structure, but at our energy scale, it's, you know, just accept it and move on, you know, sort of. Yeah. Okay, so I don't want to talk about these things much more. But you should be aware that they exist and that there are, and actually, you know, I'm now going to talk about more established stuff that has been studied. I'm going to try and focus mostly on relatively recent ideas or ideas that I think are useful to you. But, you know, perhaps there'll be some breakthrough in the future in one of these approaches. This in particular, I'm very interested in. But who knows? Okay. So I'm going to, sadly, for you guys, keep banging on about the pions. And now discuss pseudo-Goldstone models of the Higgs. Normally call these PNGBs, pseudo-Nambu-Goldstone boson. Pseudo because a true Goldstone boson is exactly massless, and the Higgs is not massless, so it has to be pseudo, in just the same way that the QCD pions are pseudo-Goldstone bosons. They are not exactly massless, but the reason that they're so much lighter than all of the other states in QCD is because they are Goldstone bosons of an approximately broken global symmetry. So there is a bit of jargon there, which I want to now explain. So Veronica did spontaneously broken symmetries, right? So you will have some, all of you will have some familiarity with that. But the idea is the following. So imagine you start with some continuous global symmetry group G. So G could be SUN, it could be U1 or SO3 or something like this. It's a continuous global symmetry. And then at some scale, you spontaneously break it to a subgroup H. So this could be, for example, SU3, and this could be SU2. Or like in the standard model, this could be SU2 cross U1, and this could be just U1. Then some of the generators of that group are known as broken. So these generators, the notation we use is that it's the coset, which basically means the leftover bit. After you've broken G to H, there's some generators that are left over that are spontaneous, that no longer correspond to symmetries of this theory that are linearly realized. And we say that they're in the coset. So this guy here, this group here, is still unbroken. So this is an unbroken symmetry. And by unbroken, what I really mean is linearly realized. And by linearly realized, I mean that you see the symmetry acting on the things that the representations of that symmetry in the usual way. So for an SU2 symmetry, you take the representations of SU2 and it acts in a particular way. For example, the fundamental representation, you can see it as being multiplying a two-component vector by a unitary 2x2 matrix. So that's what we mean by we talk about unbroken and broken, but actually nothing's ever broken. But we talk about what we're really talking about is linearly realized and non-linearly realized. So here, these are the broken generators. What this means is actually that the symmetry is actually always there, but these are now the symmetry is now non-linearly realized. And the way to see that this symmetry is non-linearly realized is that is through the particles which are known as Goldstone bosons. So Nambu and Goldstone proved that for every one of these broken generators, if this was an exact symmetry, for every one of these broken generators, you get a massless particle. Essentially, you get a massless degree of freedom. And the non-linearly realized acts on those as you see it being realized by the way it acts on those Goldstone bosons. And for example, at lowest order, the way it acts on a Goldstone boson, let's call our Goldstone boson phi, is that it acts as a shift on the whatever the Goldstone boson is, phi plus c. So here we see it linearly realized. We're essentially going to be multiplying by matrices and things like this. Here it's non-linearly realized, and you sort of need the Goldstone boson to see how that is. So all of the symmetry is actually always there. It was always there here, and it's always there here. But the way you see it in the Lagrangian, in the action, is different. And in fact, that's exactly what happened in QCD. So in QCD, there were, with regards to the pions, you can think of the two lightest flavors of quarks, the up and down quarks. And in the limit where they have zero mass, there's a chiral symmetry, which we discussed yesterday. This is a phase rotation of a fermion. There's a chiral symmetry that is SU2 left, acting on the left-hand components of those quarks, and SU2 right, acting on the right-hand components of those quarks. When QCD becomes strongly coupled and those quarks become bound together, they condense. So there's a vacuum expectation value for a given pair of those quarks. And that condensation spontaneously breaks the SU2 left cross SU2 right down to the diagonal subgroup, which is SU2 vector. So we've started with two SU2s. We only have one SU2. So we've lost three generators in the process. We should have three Goldstone bosons. And Bob's your uncle. 1, 2, 3. So that's how we understand the pion Lagrangian, really, why these guys are light. It's Goldstone's theorem. So the question is, can you do this for the Higgs? The answer, theoretically, is yes, you can. Where's the hockey stick?
It's up.
In theory, yes, you can. In practice, there are experimental limits, so it's now getting harder and harder, but you can do it. So what is the recipe if you want to do this for the Higgs? The basic recipe is the following. So you would have some group G like this. You might gauge a subgroup of it. Let's call it G tilde. So for example, if you started with an SU3 gauge group, an SU3 continuous symmetry, you might want to gauge all of it, so then you have a SU3 gauge symmetry, or you might choose to gauge a subgroup like SU2 or U1 or something like that. And then you spontaneously break it to a subgroup H, where you may have gauged some subgroup of that guy, H tilde. Then the number of Goldstone bosons you will get is equal to the number of generators in G minus the ones that were gauged, because if you spontaneously break a gauged group, then the Goldstone bosons get eaten, right, to become the massive longitudinal modes of the gauged bosons. So we have minus dim of G tilde, because those guys were eaten, minus the number of Goldstones you get is the ones you started off with, minus the ones that you that you still have, the minus the generators that are still unbroken. So we have dim of H. This is bad notation because I'll use this for the Higgs as well. And you need this thing to be greater than or equal to 4 because the Higgs is a complex Higgs doublet. So there are 4 degrees of freedom in the Higgs doublet. So if you want the Higgs doublet to be a Goldstone boson, you need to have at least 4 Goldstone bosons in your theory. Also, you want the remaining gauge subgroup to at least include SU2 left cross U1 hypercharge. So these are some basic requirements. Now, one very simple example that you could consider that I will discuss is the following, where we have G, we start with G is SU3. Actually, it's SU3 cross U1X. The gauge subgroup will be SU2 left cross U1 right. U1 hypercharge, sorry. So what do we get for this example? We can work through it very quickly and easily. And just plug in the numbers to this vanishing equation. And we see that for this theory, the number of Goldstones, you can figure this out very quickly on your paper. The number of Goldstones will be equal to 5. Essentially, when SU3 is broken to SU2, you've gone from 8 generators to 3 generators, so there are 5 Goldstone bosons. This SU3 theory, it turns out phenomenologically, doesn't work because you can't forbid certain corrections to precision electroweak observables, basically precision constraints on the ratio of the W and the Z mass. So in the EFT, you can't forbid certain operators that are dangerous. But as a first example, it's good enough for us to go through the group theory and the structure of the theory. So as I said yesterday, when you're working with Goldstone bosons, the smart thing to do, you don't have to do it, but the smart thing to do is to package the Goldstone bosons into a field, which we would call the nonlinear representation, where we understand how the symmetry, yep.
Sorry, maybe you said it in your general formula for the number of Goldstones. Did you assume that G tilde has no intersection with H? Did you say? All of G tilde is broken.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, so sorry, G tilde is the broken gauged guys.
Right. Yep.
Absolutely. So we go to the nonlinear representation, and there's I really don't have time to go through it, but there's a very nice prescription for this, known as CCWZ, after the authors who basically explained it to us all. And what you do is you take the linear representation. So, for example, if this were spontaneously broken with a 3 of SU3, so this is like, you know, the quarks are in a 3 of SU3 color. So if the scalar field that broke this symmetry was in the 3 of SU3, then we would take that 3 of SU3, I'm going to call it sigma, and package it as the VEV of this field. So I would call sigma naught is the vacuum expectation value. So if I measure the vacuum expectation value of this guy, it's sigma naught. And then you can package the Goldstone bosons in the way that I described yesterday, where you have something like this. But now it's a non-abelian thing. So F would be the decay constant, just like the pion decay constant, which is this, essentially the scale. This is of order F. It's the scale at which the symmetry is broken. The TAs are all of the broken generators. So these are the bits that are no longer linearly realized. And the pi A's are all of the Goldstone bosons. So this looks sort of complicated. I've put a matrix in an exponential. I'm not going to apologize for that, but it may make some of you uncomfortable. But in practice, this is actually no more crazy than if you were to take, for example, a complex scalar field, like I said yesterday. We could parameterize this if we wanted, like this guy. Or we could also parameterize it in a different way. 2 degrees of freedom, 2 degrees of freedom. Turns out when you're talking about a spontaneously broken symmetry, the smart way to parameterize it is this way. Physics doesn't care how you like to parameterize it. So you could parameterize it in this way. And you could do a similar thing here where you parameterize this just as a sum of a vector now of real and imaginary components. But you will create an enormous headache for yourself, even though in every single calculation you'll get exactly the same answers. So this is just the smart way to parameterize the physics is sometimes to put something in an exponential. And that's the case here.
Pardon?
Is
there no more ways to parameterize
it? Well, there's an infinite number of ways to parameterize a complex number, I'm sure. So you can make your life infinitely painful. But
so this turns out to be the easiest thing that you can.
Yes, yes. And this why it's easiest is precisely essentially how these guys explained it, is that you can see very clearly in this representation how the nonlinear symmetry is still there, it's still realized. So here, for example, the nonlinear symmetry acts on this field by doing nothing to rho, which is this, like the radial mode. It's just a simple shift in this guy. And it's almost that here. For a non-abelian, it's a shift, but it's also, it's nonlinear. So there's a shift plus a bit of a rotation of the fields. Okay.
Weinberg has three laws of theoretical physics, one of which is you can use any variables you want in a problem, but if you use the wrong ones, you'd be sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Great. So for SU3, for our example, this we know what the broken generators are. So I'm going to call this big pi is pi a ta, which is this guy here. I'm going to write it in this way, h1, h2, 0, h1, dagger, h2, dagger. Okay, so we know that there are the generators of SU3. So these are the broken ones, but we know that all of the generators of SU3 fill out a 3x3 matrix. It's traceless. There are 8 of them. There are ones that go like 1, 1, or II, and ones that go like I and minus I, and so on. When you sum over the broken ones, which in this case are obviously not the SU2 bits, those SU2 bits were unbroken because we broke SU3 to SU2. When we sum over those broken ones with a field for each one, then I can write it in this way where H1 is complex and H2 is complex. So I can break it up like this. I plug this guy into here and I expand out my exponential. And now sigma looks like this. Actually, I'll do it on a different board. I'll do it over here, actually. Over here is better. This is going to be big. Okay, so this is very small, I'm afraid, but this weird-looking thing here is mod of h, which is just the magnitude of this guy. So it's h1, h1 dagger, plus h2, h2 dagger, all square-rooted. So if you plug this into here, this is what you will get. Now, the neat thing about this CCWZ construction is that now I can treat this in my action, like my action is just completely SU3 invariant. So I write everything down as SU3 invariants using this fundamental representation, which transforms in the normal way. It would just transform like a matrix multiplying this guy. And that will give me the complete effect. If I write down every operator that I'm allowed, constrained by this SU3 symmetry, it will give me the complete effect of action for all of the Goldstone bosons. So this is the construction that will get you straight away with very little effort to the pion Lagrangian. But doing that, we can already see, for exactly the same reason that I was worried about the pions, we see a fly in the ointment, which is that we have gauge interactions, and we've gauged this SU2 subgroup. And when you gauge a subgroup of a group, then you've actually broken that subgroup, and we can see exactly how that works. Because now the gauge interactions of our Goldstone bosons will go something like this. And when you expand that out, you will get exactly the gauge interactions of the Higgs boson that we know and love. You get these guys here. Yep.
So in the matrix pi, what happened to the fifth Goldstone boson?
Ah, you know, I knew you were going to ask that. yeah, so he's in there as well, but I don't want to talk about him. Yeah, he's there. And this example is not a fully working model anyway, so I'm ignoring him for now. But yes, he's in principle there. There are ways you can make him a bit heavier than the Higgs, but not arbitrarily so, without spoiling the whole story. But yes, absolutely.
With no subscripts, you got a bunch of sign magnitudes.
Yeah, it's just what I said. This is the mod of. Okay. Right, so we write down the gauge interactions. They look like this. But when we expand out to high orders, we will see that we get just the gauge interactions of the Higgs boson. So number one, we've had enormous success because we've now managed to package the Goldstone boson behaving just like the QCD pion, which was what we wanted to do. But then we also have a problem straight away, which is that we know from the effective theory that this guy has, from the analogy with the pions, this guy has actually broken the shift symmetry of the Goldstone bosons, which is what we knew because when you gauge a subgroup of a symmetry, you're actually breaking that part of the symmetry. So we've explicitly broken SU3 here by gauging the SU2 part in here. And when we did that, we broke the shift symmetry, but that shift symmetry was the only thing that was keeping the Goldstone boson light in the first place. Essentially, it was actually the SU3 symmetry that is keeping it light, and it's the non-linearly realized part of the SU3 symmetry, which is the shift symmetry that's keeping it light. So we're in trouble, and there's no way that you can forbid terms now that go just like we had before, g squared over 16 pi squared lambda squared. So for example, if they're, sorry, Higgs squared. Let's do a little h squared. So you can't forbid these terms, at least in the simplest example. And for example, if you really wanted the Higgs to be like a pion and there's some strongly coupled physics at the cutoff of the theory, then you would expect exactly what happened for the charged pion to happen, which is that you do get mass corrections and the cutoff can't be too far away. So here, if you want to keep the Higgs light, then this cutoff shouldn't be too far away. It turns out that the electroweak interactions are weak enough that this prefactor is small enough that you can keep the Higgs mass as light as you need it to be, so long as lambda is less than, I think, probably something like 2 TeV. So you can sort of get away with it, but in this simple example, if this described nature, there would be new heavy vector mesons, just like in QCD. They would have to be around a scale of something like 2 TeV to avoid fine-tuning, which was the thing that you wanted to do in the first place. I won't discuss it, but there are actually ways to make this Wilson coefficient smaller and smaller. So this is at one loop. You can play tricks known for the most part as little Higgs models, where you actually take multiple structures of this. Say you did two copies of SU3 and you spontaneously broke the whole lot. Then you'd have two copies of Goldstone bosons, but then imagine you only gauged the one linear combination of those two SU2s living in the two SU3s. Then it turns out that if you do that trick, I won't discuss it, if you do that trick, you can make this prefactor smaller, it can become a two-loop thing, or if you did three copies, you can make it a three-loop thing, and so on. So there are ways to make this prefactor smaller, but it will always be there because the gauge interactions break the shift symmetry. Things get even more interesting when we think about interactions with the top quark. So are there any questions at this point, by the way? I'm sort of moving quite quickly. Nope. Excellent. So how can we have interactions with the top quark? So we know that to respect the SU3 symmetry, we can just plug this nonlinear realization into the action everywhere in a way that respects SU3. So to introduce interactions with fermions, then in the standard model, you would have all the usual guys, and then something like sigma with the Yukawa coupling. It's called lambda. Lambda, sigma, and then a fermion, I will call it Q bar. This is Q3, because it's going to be the top quark, so the third generation, U3. Now, this is the right-handed guy. He just had charge under hypercharge. But this guy here would be contracted in this way. So for example, the doublet part of this, we want to have the normal, this is the normal Higgs, or a pretty good approximation of the normal Higgs boson doublet. So we want at least this guy to have the top doublet in it. But also, we want this thing to be SU3 invariant. Otherwise, if we break the SU3 symmetry, just like with the gauge interactions, we will introduce the same quadratic sensitivity to the physics at the cutoff that we were trying to avoid in the same place. So what do we better do? So we had better embed Q3 into a triplet of this SU3 symmetry. So here you would have something like the bottom quark, or let's go top, T left, bottom left. And now you have to have a third colored quark if this guy respects SU3. So if we write this down here, this whole interaction is now SU3 invariant. We have a full representation of SU3 and a full representation of SU3. The whole thing is SU3 invariant. So this interaction will never give you any problems. It will never give you any quadratic divergences, and you're sorted. The problem is that we do not have an extra massless quark, right? If you did this for all of the generations, we wouldn't have a top quark, a bottom quark alone. We'd have a top quark, a bottom quark, and some other colored guy who's massless. And you would get that extra colored guy also for the up quarks and the charm quark and so on. Okay, so what can you do? Well, one possible thing you can do is bury your head in the sand and just set this guy to zero. So explicitly break the SU3 symmetry. Now, when we've explicitly broken the SU3 symmetry, you get a problem, which is, again, you've broken the symmetry. There's nothing protecting you anymore. Let me call this lambda top. And there's nothing to stop you getting corrections to the Higgs mass that are going like 3 lambda top squared over 16 pi squared, cutoff squared, Higgs squared. So in this case, just as with the gauge interactions and just as with the gauge interactions of the pions, if this correction isn't going to be too large, then this guy here would need to be less than around something like 400 or 500 GeV. That's what you get to have something like this be something like 125 squared, 125 GeV, because this lambda top is not so small. Yep.
Why does the third quark have to be massless?
Here, because, so this is pairing up chirality, so a Dirac fermion has a pair of a left and a right, and I've only got one right, and I've got three lefts. Mm-hmm. So, and then if I also add in the bottom Yukawa, so it'd be something like this. This is a good question, by the way. Add in the bottom Yukawa, I've got, in here I've got three left-handed fermions, and here I've only got two right-handed fermions. So I can't make three Dirac fermions from that. So I always have one leftover left-handed massless guy.
So you just find that like, there's six quirks. You can just do like top, bottom, charm, up, down, strange.
Top, bottom, like in here, make this guy the charm.
The number of them you have is divisible by three.
Right, yeah, but here you would actually have the wrong hypercharge. So this is a doublet with hypercharge a half, and you would get the wrong, you wouldn't actually get the charm. But this is an excellent question.
Can you not make the right-handed quarks extend the right-handed quarks with SU3 triplet?
Yes, you can do that.
Yeah.
Yep, but then you have the full, you will have all of those extra guys on the right-hand side. So there are models that do that, but generically, you can't get rid of all of them. if you keep the symmetry, which is essentially, we already know this from the standard model, because the standard model does not respect this global symmetry at low energies, because we just have the top quarks, and as I said, there's no, we can't find a symmetry within the standard model, linearly or non-linearly realized, to protect the Higgs. So typically, generically, by extending the symmetry structure, you will not find a way to get rid of those extra guys. However, it is was for a while a cottage industry to do precisely that, find different representations and different things and see some cases they work out better, work out worse, and so on. Any other questions? These are very good questions. Nope. Okay, so we could bury our head in the sand, but then the cutoff would have to be about 400 GeV. And if this were a strongly coupled model, just like QCD was, this means literally all hell would have broken loose at the LHC. We would have seen an entire new slew of innumerable numbers of particles. We would have to not, you know, just put a new table into the PDG, but we would actually have to double the size of the PDG. It would have been wonderful. But an alternative approach is to keep this guy. So let's say we keep this guy. So we have this term in this case. So this is case one, and this will be case two. So we keep this guy. But then we add for him in a way that completely breaks the SU3 symmetry, but in a controlled way. We add a partner for him. So he was having trouble partnering up to get a Dirac mass. But we can provide that for him. And we will call his partner TC. So I've explicitly pulled him out of this triplet of SU3. So I've explicitly broken the symmetry here. But this is the only term that's broken the symmetry. So whatever way you may wish to calculate it, I guarantee you that when you calculate the corrections to the Higgs mass, they have to be of this form here. This is the only guy who's breaking the SU3 symmetry, so any corrections to its mass have to be proportional to it. So this is that same old Spurion argument all over again. And they will look like this. So why is this handy? This is useful because the cutoff is still well above this. I could put the cutoff at 2 TeV or something like this, you know, maybe satisfying this expectation here. And I no longer have quadratic sensitivity to the cutoff if this guy is below the cutoff in mass. So if I don't want this to be too fine-tuned, again, you put the numbers in, you'll obviously get the same answer. So this guy shouldn't be heavier than like 400 GeV, just unless if we want to avoid starting fine-tuning the Higgs potential. But what you've won is that in this case, all of the strongly coupled physics of the cutoff has to come in at 400 GeV. In this case, only a new colored fermion on his own will do the job for you. So these guys are known as top partners. And they are absolutely ubiquitous in models that attempt to address the hierarchy problem. And it's for quite a generic reason. So those of you familiar with supersymmetry will know that there are stops in supersymmetry. And those stops are also charged under QCD, just like these guys are charged under QCD. And the reason is actually really, really simple to see. The reason is that in the standard model, we have no symmetry, whether it's linearly or non-linearly realized, that can keep the Higgs mass lighter than the cutoff. So we would like to have some sort of symmetry, be it a global symmetry like this or supersymmetry or something like that. So we would like to this theory to have a symmetry, but the only way for this theory to have a symmetry is if you are to add particles such that all of the standard model particles can be packaged into representations of that symmetry. So here the symmetry was SU3, and we had to add a particle to allow the standard model particles to be packaged in a representation of that symmetry. Similarly, in supersymmetry, if you want to have the action respect supersymmetry, you have to add the scalar partner of the top so that they can be packaged into a representation of the symmetry. We know of it as a superfield. And this is completely generic. What is also completely generic is that these guys are colored. And the LHC limits on new colored particles are now very stringent. They're not absolutely bulletproof, but they're pretty much bulletproof. And we are pretty certain that there are no colored particles, be they stops, quarks, or new heavy fermions that are colored, below about 400 GeV. So this is a big puzzle. And it's sort of the cleanest way to see what's going on, what the problem is with the Higgs sector. Lambda top happens to be in units of h-bar equals 1, which, as I've said, is not always the best thing to do. But in natural units, lambda top is 1, essentially. And that's a pretty big coupling. And it's the biggest coupling in the standard model, so it's unsurprising. And it's also the biggest coupling that breaks any potential symmetry or, acting on the Higgs boson. So it's clear then that all of the biggest problems of the hierarchy problem are going to be concentrated around the top quark sector. The top quark if you want to have a symmetry that can protect the Higgs, the top quark will have to be packaged into some representation of that symmetry. In this case, it was SU3, but whatever. And when it's packaged in with all of the, with whatever new particles are required, the SU3 color will have to commute with that symmetry, which means that the new particles will be colored. So because lambda top is so large, we expect new colored particles near, you know, the 300 or 400 GeV range, and they haven't shown up at the LHC. So what do you do? So are there any questions at this point? Yep.
What is TC?
TC is the partner that we added for the top partner to be able to give him a Dirac mass.
Okay.
So TC.
You're adding 2 new particles then.
Right. Exactly. Absolutely. Yes. So you don't just need this, because if you just had this, he would be massless. So you add this guy to have the symmetry, and then you add this guy to be able to give him a mass in a way that's not too dangerous for the Higgs. Any other questions? Nope, great. Okay, so this is really the nub of the problem that people have been thinking about a lot in the past decade or so. And unsurprisingly, because you should never underestimate the creativity of model builders, people have come up with a way around this problem, which is known by the moniker of neutral naturalness, which is what I want to discuss in the last 25 minutes here. All right,
20 minutes.
So the idea with neutral naturalness, and actually the best ideas came just before the LHC switched on, but they've really been popular after the LHC switched on, is to see, is there a way that you could have these sorts of nice properties where you resolve the naturalness problems for the Higgs coming from the large value of the top Yukawa coupling without having to introduce any colored particles. So the argument I give you is sort of hand-wavy that you should always have to introduce colored particles, but it's a pretty good argument. And the fun is in finding caveats to that argument. And that's what neutral naturalness is. So neutral naturalness may mean, completely, everything is completely gauge neutral, or it may mean that actually some of the new particles you introduce carry electric charge, for example, which is sort of not what we normally mean by neutral. But the real key thing is to avoid charges for the new particles under QCD. Because QCD, anything that is charged under QCD is produced prolifically at the LHC because it's a proton collider. So even if they don't, if something charged under QCD is not coupling to quarks, you've always got the gluons, and it has to couple to the gluons, and you should be able to produce it. So the whole game is to find models where you can do something like this, but you don't have any new colored particles. And what I want to talk about is a model known as the twin Higgs, which realizes this. So the idea of the twin Higgs is that you take the standard model as it is, And unsurprisingly, you add an entire twin standard model. By the way, just I should just say that this is definitely not textbook material. So I'm telling you about this because I think it's interesting. It's really something that people are working on. Papers are being published on right at the moment. But you will not find it in any textbooks, which also means that it's not necessarily, you know, as widely accepted as, for example, supersymmetry, where you'll find many textbooks. My own philosophy is that nothing should be widely accepted at this stage, because we really don't know what's going on, so we should explore all ideas. So this is not, you know, I hope I don't get criticized for it, but this is not, you know, standard. Well, it is standard BSM now, but it's not standard lecture course material. But anyway. Okay, so you take the standard model and you take the twin standard model, and there'll be some scalar potential for the Higgs, and there'll be some scalar potential for the twin Higgs. And if it takes this form, then you can start to get an idea about what happens. So we have the standard model Higgs boson and the twin Higgs boson. So these are just mass terms for them both. And then a quartic interaction. And then let me write something else. Another quartic interaction looks like this. So capital H is just the Higgs, standard model Higgs. HT is the twin Higgs. Yep.
Do you need to keep the mass the same for...
Right, so this is the first point. Sorry.
My question is this middle to the second term, do you want that to be squared?
Thank you. Okay, so why did I write the mass squared to be equal? Why did I write this in this term? Why did I write this in this way? So this is the most general quartic you could write down, because, well, not quite. This is the most general potential that you could write down that respects a symmetry, which is that you exchange the twin, you take your theory, and you exchange every single particle in the standard model sector with every single particle in the twin sector. So there's just one symmetry here, which is a Z2 symmetry, exchanging everything. And if I do that, then this is the most general potential that I can write down. Now, imagine I can find some way, and there are ways to do this, but imagine at the UV scale, I can find some way of getting rid of this operator. I'll never be able to get fully rid of it, but imagine I can make it very, very small. Then I actually have an extra symmetry in this theory, which you can see, because if I take, for example, take both of these doublets, so I have a doublet in the standard model and a doublet in the twin sector. If I package both of these doublets into a fourplet, like this, you can see that this scalar potential actually respects an SU4 symmetry. Okay, because I can write this as m squared Higgs tilde squared plus lambda over 2 Higgs tilde to the 4. Plus this guy that I'm going to ignore for the time being. So then we can start to play exactly the sort of games that we were playing with a spontaneously broken global symmetry. So, but only if we can forbid this term. So this term respects the Z2 symmetry. So this Z2 symmetry is not actually quite enough for you. But at whatever the UV scale is, so if it's a strongly coupled scenario, like with QCD, then you would need to have some sort of reason why this coupling is forbidden, and people have found it. Or if at the UV scale you have, for example, a supersymmetric model, there are actually very easy ways of showing that you can avoid having this operator. For now, I'm not going to explain what those reasons are, but if you believe me, then you can have just this scalar potential here, which respects an SU4 symmetry. So now, just as before, the Higgs doublets will get a vacuum expectation value, and you can see here, if this is a negative mass squared, one up to an overall SU4 rotation, one of these guys will get a VEV, which exactly cancels this. I could write this as minus, V squared minus H squared, all squared if I wanted. And you will see that when you minimize this potential, you get the scalar potential, you get a VEV for one of the Higgses. And when you get the VEV for the one of the Higgses, so I'll say that I'll choose by an SU4 rotation for it to be in this direction, for example. So this is just like we had in the background with the SU3 model, but we're doing SU4. Then I will have spontaneously broken SU4 to SU3. So SU4 to SU3 would give me 7 Goldstone bosons. So those are 3 Goldstone bosons living in this bit, and 4 Goldstone bosons living in this bit. Remember, this bit was the standard model Higgs. So naively, we have a problem because we've got way too many Goldstone bosons, but this twin sector isn't literally an identical copy of the standard model. So SU2 left cross U1 hypercharge is gauge symmetry. And that SU2 gauge symmetry is the bit that gauges this SU2 here, acting on this guy. So these 3 Goldstone bosons are eaten by the twin gauge bosons.
Sorry, how do you see that there are
4 Goldstone
bosons in the standard sector and
Yeah, so I mean, in general, they're where they live is not very well defined, because before I talk about gauging the gauge group, I could always perform an SU4 rotation to move this anywhere. So there are 7 Goldstone bosons. But if I do the SU4 transformation such that the VEV is living in here, then you can look at how many degrees of freedom you have. So you always get you will always get one massive, what we call the radial mode, which is like the Higgs boson of this symmetry breaking. But then all the other guys will be Goldstone bosons. So you see we've got 8 degrees of freedom in here. The radial mode is the VEV. So this is the VEV of the radial mode. So the radial mode gets carried around with F. So the other 7 degrees of freedom, which are the Goldstone bosons, live in here. I have no F here, so there'll be two, and there can only be 1 in here. Yep.
Wait, what was the original symmetry of the potential SU4 and not U4?
Oh yeah, it is U4. It is U4.
U4 to U3.
Yeah, exactly. So it's the same counting.
Doesn't matter.
And actually, the other interactions break that U1. But yeah, really, it's SU4 cross U1x is one way of thinking of it. But yes, absolutely.
Are there any perceptible, observable differences between standard model and particle and the twin MRI counterpart, like charge, mass?
They're all exactly the same at this level. It's an entire copy of the standard model.
So if you were to encounter an electron, you can't tell if it's an electron or a twin electron.
Well, so it's an entire copy. So even the gauge bosons are copied. So our photon does not talk to those electrons. The photon of the twin sector talks to those electrons. It's an entire copy. Yeah.
So that's why you have to switch the whole thing. Like if you just
everything
switch 2 Higgs, then they wouldn't talk.
Exactly. So it's an entire copy of the standard model. Every single particle in the standard model copied. But at the moment, the only way they talk, and in these theories in general, which is why they're so difficult to test experimentally, the only way they talk is through the 2 Higgses, through the Higgs portal. Okay.
Is it natural as issue not writing down the gauge portal? Because you could have one to the top of each other, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So it is generated at 3 loops. You have to go through the Higgs portal to generate it. But it could in principle be there, and it's actually useful. There are lots of cosmological problems with having an entire copy of the standard model, and to get rid of those, sometimes it's useful to introduce it. Yes, but it also respects the exchange symmetry, so it should be there. Yes. Okay, so I'll need to speed up a little bit to get to what's going on. But so these three Goldstone bosons were eaten, and we have four, and we can identify them exactly with the Higgs boson. There are actually lots of issues here. In fact, because of the gauging, because you can generically get terms like this, the VEVs will want to live half in here and half in here, which means that you would have the twin symmetry breaking scale at the same scale as the electroweak symmetry breaking scale. and there are problems with that, but I'm not going to have time to go into those sorts of details. So I have hidden a few, I have some skeletons in here, and I need to actually, to get the VEV to point mostly in the twin sector direction, I have to introduce extra mass terms that actually break the exchange symmetry. But they don't spoil anything with quadratic divergences just because it's a mass term, it's not an interaction. But anyway, so there are bodies buried, but this is the story. Now we can calculate what the quadratic divergences look like, for example, for the Higgs and for the twin Higgs from gauge loops and top loops and things, because this Higgs has his normal everyday interactions with the top quark. This Higgs has his normal everyday interactions with the top quark. They each give you a quadratic divergence. So you would normally expect there to be a problem. But this is where the exchange, this is where the sort of the clever trick is. The exchange symmetry comes to the rescue because the gauge corrections look like this. G squared over 16 pi squared lambda squared squared plus G twin squared over 16 pi squared lambda twin squared, twin Higgs squared. The Yukawa corrections, you know, have 3 lambda top squared over 16 pi squared. I'm just going to get a bit sloppy here for time. Sig plus 3 lambda top twin squared over 16 pi squared lambda twin squared Higgs twin squared. And you see that there are quadratic divergences in this theory. You haven't gotten rid of them, but the quadratic divergences respect the SU4 symmetry because they respect the exchange symmetry. So they will never give rise to a quadratic divergence for the Goldstone bosons because they themselves do not actually break the continuous global symmetry that you were using in the first place. So there are quadratic divergences, but purely because of the exchange symmetry, they accidentally also respect the SU4 symmetry. So they do not cause a problem. Yes?
I feel like this looks to me like there should be an fairly obvious signal from this from a ton of what would be essentially, from our perspective, dark matter behaving like baryonic matter.
Right.
Because it would, so you just... You could only see gravitationally, but it wouldn't be behaving like non-baryonic dark matter.
Right, so there are plenty of good dark matter candidates in this theory, yep. Yep, it's great.
Would lambda and lambda 2 have to be the same?
Exactly. So this is telling you something really, really important about these models, which is that the cutoff, that whatever the physics is at the UV completion of this thing, it has to respect the exchange symmetry. And that's something that people sometimes don't take seriously. But if you have, in the UV, if you don't respect this exchange symmetry, you're doomed. Exactly. So this is why I wrote lambda t and not just an overall lambda. All of the physics in the UV has to know and love this exchange symmetry. Okay. But now, what this means, so just like there were no quadratic divergences from the tops in that SU3 model, here there are no quadratic divergences from the tops because the quadratic divergences respect the SU4 symmetry, but there are still top partners, which are the top quarks now of the twin sector. So if we did the same nonlinear realization of this story, we would see that, in fact, the Higgs boson inherits a coupling to the twin top quarks. And it looks like this. So the action, once you go to this nonlinear parameterization that I discussed before, you'd have the normal guy with the Higgs and the standard model top quarks. And then you inherit for the Higgs, you inherit a coupling to the twin top quarks starting from this interaction here. So you start from here, but actually when you go to the theory even below the mass scale of the new top quarks, you inherit a coupling for the Higgs boson, which looks like this. I think this is in the problem set. where this is the mass of now the twin top quarks. And you can see in this way that the quadratic divergences cancel. Another way of seeing it is that you can keep the original twin Higgs, and the quadratic divergences in terms of loop diagrams for the Higgs look like this. But then there's also a diagram involving the Higgs and the twin Higgs, where you get a coupling between the two of them. This is known as the Higgs portal from this interaction here. When the twin Higgs gets this VEV F, you get a trilinear term where you have two Higgses and one of the, what we call the radial mode, the heavy Higgs boson. Let's call them Higgs twin. And you have loops then of the twin top quarks here. This would be the twin top quarks, which cancel the quadratic divergences. This is all exactly as it had to be because the quadratic divergences respected the SU4 symmetry. So we already knew this was going to happen, but if you like to draw Feynman diagrams, this is the way to see it. But these guys are not charged under QCD. They're completely neutral, hence neutral naturalness. They're much, much harder to see at the LHC. The experimental bounds are very, very weak. The only way you can produce them is through this Higgs portal. So for example, the only way to probe these sorts of theories at the LHC is that you go through the Higgs portal and you can decay into, for example, twin gluons, just like the Higgs boson can decay into gluons. It can now decay into twin gluons also. Those twin gluons would hadronize in the twin sector, so not RQCD. You'd get twin mesons, twin bottom mesons, and so on, that can eventually decay back into the standard model particles through the Higgs portal. So these signals are very, very suppressed. They're very tricky to search for, but you can search for them at the LHC. And that's sort of why this class of models is very interesting. You can resolve this hierarchy problem, or at least the little hierarchy problem, in scenarios that actually at colliders look completely different from what we're used to talking about. And I think I should wrap it up. Oh, question.
Isn't this constrained by the limit bounds on self-interaction for dark matter?
No, it's great for self-interaction for dark matter. So the bounds on self-interaction, or the hints for self-interactions for dark matter, depending on what level of optimism you have.
Yeah, it can't be that strongly interacting. You know this.
Let me finish. So the bounds are pretty much exactly what you get for the neutron-proton cross-section. So QCD gives you the ideal self-interaction dark matter candidate, self-interacting dark matter candidate. So the strong interaction is very good for self-interacting dark matter, and the twin baryons, the twin protons and so on, of the twin sector are very good self-interacting dark matter candidates. The problem is that you need to be able to switch off the long-range interactions, which are the twin electromagnetism. So you essentially need to break twin electromagnetism. But in that case, the bounds are actually stronger, not so much from the fact that this could potentially be the dark matter, because you have to produce it in the first place. So it's a candidate, but you need the production mechanism. But even if you just had the extra twin photon, which you do in this vanilla scenario, that is constrained by constraints on extra relativistic species, because it's light. And it would be hot, because if you reheat the universe to above this twin breaking scale, you heat up this sector and that photon would be left around. So it's not so much the dark matter part that's the problem, it's the twin photon itself. But that's where all the model building comes in. You need to find a way to get rid of this twin photon, and people have found a way. But ideally, you want a way that does that without breaking the exchange symmetry. And it turns out there are ways of doing that, but that is literally something that people are working on now. You know, I saw a seminar trying to solve this problem 2 weeks ago about a paper that's not even been put on the archive yet. So, which is why I wanted to tell you about this stuff. This is really something that people are talking about a lot at the minute. But there are many bodies buried and cosmological questions still to consider. Yep.
Sorry, I didn't get this, but is it coupled to the normal sector, let's say? So you have this twin sector and you want to detect it. And is it supposed to interact with the normal sector of matter, so you have to identify it all over your detector? Or do you expect like to start to see something when it decays into a normal matter?
Right, exactly. So you produce through the Higgs portal, so the only interaction between these two sectors is this guy here. So you produce the standard model Higgs boson, and it could decay into twin sector particles, including, for example, twin gluons. Those twin gluons don't interact with us, they don't care about us. They hadronize into twin baryons that don't really care about us. But some of those mesons and baryons will decay back through the Higgs portal. For example, the twin B quarks have a tiny little coupling to the Higgs from the Higgs portal, and they could decay back through the Higgs portal into standard model particles that we would see. But it would typically be a big char. It would be a char in the twin sector, but what we would see is things like pairs of something coming through the Higgs portal to us. So it would be typically things like pairs of B quarks. But those twin sector mesons might be quite light. So you would see very soft B quarks. This is why it's quite challenging at detectors. Also, these particles have inherited such a small coupling that they may actually be quite long-lived. So you would have displaced pairs of soft B quarks and things like this. So the collider signatures are totally different to what we normally think about. Yep.
So I have something I don't like about treating Higgs as pi r, because we try so hard to find an elementary scalar. And like pi r is very understood, but it's not fundamental to group freedom, right? So when you go high enough, energy is broken. Similar to if you treat Higgs like that.
Right.
We try so hard to find an elementary Higgs, and then we say it's not elementary.
That's why.
God doesn't care what you...
I should say completely, like, because God doesn't care about what we think,
yeah.
So hierarchy might not be a problem, right?
Oh, but... So that you're saying the charged pion mass doesn't get corrections from the rho meson?
No, the pion does.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, like, Higgs could have been the one of the very unique things that could be a fundamental scalar. That
right, but then there's still a hierarchy problem.
That's exactly
the hierarchy problem. Yeah, but I'm saying the SUSY solution doesn't have to treat it as a not fundamental stuff. You just have to.
Yeah, I'm not. No, I'm not. At no point did I say the Higgs has to be like a pion.
Yeah,
the question was, can it be like a pion? And if it is, this is what happens.
Yeah. I'm just saying that's the thing I don't like about it.
I care as much as God. You know, I just...
I'm fine. Anyway.
Yep.
So do you have to break the Z2 symmetry, did you say, at one point?
Do you have to break it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so... So it's automatically broken under RG evolution, even if I manage to avoid this guy. He is generated at one loop from proportional, for example, the top.
Wait, that doesn't break Z2.
Yes, this doesn't break the Z2. But let me finish. So you will always get this guy. And once you have this guy, you minimize the potential and you find the VEVs go in both pieces. I can't get it into one.
It's spontaneously broken.
Yeah. But so if this is here, the VEVs go in both directions. But then you haven't won anything because the VEVs are both at the same place. So the cutoff, you haven't won any loop factors in pushing your cutoff away because there's not a hierarchy of scales. You don't go from V to F and then the cutoff. You go from V to the same place as F and then the cutoff. So if the VEVs are both the same magnitude, you haven't actually gained anything. They will be the same magnitude if you have this. So the way to then get the VEV to push into, for example, the twin sector, to be more in the twin sector than in the standard model sector, because in the end of the day, this is really V here and F here, is to add extra things like masses that don't respect the exchange symmetry, a mass that's
that
more.
I mean, you have no way of keeping the masses of the twin fermions the same as the standard model fermions.
Yeah, it's more that they want to be, and you have to add soft breaking of the Z2. To push them to be heavier. Yep.
Do you have like an intuitive way of seeing that the quadratic divergence is cancelled? Because like you have like fermion loaded, both of the diagonal fermions.
Right. Yeah.
Extra minus.
Right. Yes. But I'm lazy and I try to avoid doing loop calculations. So the intuitive way is to see that the quadratic divergences respect the SU4 symmetry. So they can never lead, if you say, for example, switched off the gauge interactions and things like this, they can never lead to a quadratic divergence for the Higgs because the Higgs is the goldstone of the SU4. So that's the intuitive way of seeing it. You never need to do the loop calculation. But you can sit down and do it, and you do actually find, although this is actually a plus, when you do this calculation, you get a minus sign, and they do cancel each other. But they had to.
Where from? I don't see the extra minus.
Pardon?
Like, where did you edit from?
The propagator of Higgs, heavy Higgs, goes like 1 over minus heavy Higgs mass squared, so you get a minus sign from there. But you shouldn't ever, symmetries tell you everything and you can avoid doing that. But if you do it, you will get the answer that you expect from the symmetries. Which is really stop there, I think.